Retro Nerd.
I think that's true of any art. Any art that has me challenge my ground in thinking and makes me look at things in a whole new way. I don't necessarily agree with them, but wow, I never thought of them in that way. I think that's good. I think that's part of why art matters, and that's why it's important. And with Star Wars is no exception.
Entering the hive of scum and villainy.
I love democracy.
The Imperial Senate will no longer be of any concern to us.
My allegiance is to the Republic, to democracy!
Rebellions are built on hope.
Your focus determines your reality.
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
Hello and welcome to Beltway Banthas, a Star Wars podcast live from the hive of scum and villainy in our very own galaxy, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Stephen Kent, and today, welcome back, it's Thanksgiving week, the holidays are upon us, and this will make for the Beltway Banthas November broadcast. I have been going back and forth all month on what I wanted to talk to you about. And then it sort of just fell into my lap thanks to a listener tweet. Listener Dominic Nardi sent me an article from The Hollywood Reporter on the politics of The Mandalorian's newest episodes. And frankly, I thought it made for a perfect bit to talk about in relation to our recent episodes on the clash between federalism, localism, and a strong centralized government as it pertains to Star Wars and our own world. So I had spoken to David French of the Dispatch about the Death Star. And as you know, the Death Star was an answer, not the answer, but an answer to the biggest political problem in Star Wars, which is how the blazes do you govern a galaxy under one government? It's just too big. The core worlds closest to the centers of power in the Old Republic became rich, cultured, and disinterested with the troubles of the worlds further from them, that's the Outer Rim, and the likes of places like Navarro in The Mandalorian, where we can see Carl Weathers' character Greef Karga, now mayor and trying to move the planet forward into some semblance of prosperity in the New Republic era. Now, the Republic fell apart because of the separatist crisis, which at its populist core was brought about by worlds realizing that incidents like the invasion of Naboo could happen to just about anyone, and the Republic couldn't really do anything about it. And they also didn't care to either. Now, the Empire's approach to maintaining unity in the galaxy was fear. Like, they just wanted to have everyone under the Tarkin Doctrine, which was this idea that, you know, you could actually unite the galaxy under fear of destruction.
The regional governors now have direct control over their territories. Fear will keep the local systems in line.
Whereas the Republic promised economic prosperity and access to trade routes instead, very much the neoliberal post-World War II promise of the Allied states, they failed to deliver on it because of corporate capture. Neither approach worked in Star Wars. Neoliberalism in the stars failed, and so did outright tyranny under the Tarkin Doctrine and the Death Star. The Death Star did not cripple or tame the galaxy. It united the rebellion under fear of death, and it forced them, like we talked about in our last episode, to put aside their differences in the details of fighting back to stop the Empire first and figure out the rest later. Now, we all know that they win. The rebellion wins in Return of the Jedi, and then they go on to fight the Imperial remnants for a couple more years before they eventually surrender after the Battle of Jakku and sign the Galactic Concordance, signed by Mos Eimeda, the big blue horned figure who was always flanking Palpatine and end up being the de facto leader of the Empire after the Emperor and Vader's death. Now, when the New Republic is founded and hosted for its first capital on Chandrila, the New Republic opts to move its capital around every few years, presumably to counteract what happened with the centralization of power and wealth on Coruscant. You still have the problem of Outer Rim versus Core Worlds having very much divergent interests. The Outer Rim was very much abandoned by the Republic. You saw that when Qui-Gon Jinn and Padme landed on Tatooine in Episode 1, and, you know, the Republic credits aren't good there, it's not really actually part of the Republic, slavery is still strong on this planet, and this is just something that is very emblematic of life beyond the direct reaches of whatever these centralized governments are in the Core Worlds. And the Empire tried to tame those worlds as well with occupation and brutality, but like we said, it didn't work. It just created bleak, crime-infested worlds where you could not prosper. And after the Empire fell, you still had those same communities facing Imperial remnants, bullying and raiding them, or Imperial factions becoming their only salvation from organized crime. That's what we see at the start of The Mandalorian on Nevarro. It's plain as day. I mean, the place is dark and dirty, and there's hardly anybody out on the streets unless they look like they are quite the brute and could survive a fight and handle themselves. But in this new episode, episode 4 of season 2 of The Mandalorian, Nevarro is alive. It's bustling with commerce and trade, entrepreneurship, and education. Kids are in school. Like, how cool was that scene? I've never seen a Star Wars school before. Heck, we barely ever saw a child in Nevarro besides the child last season because the place was just so darn dangerous. But after The Mandalorian, Cara Dune, and Grief defeated Moff Gideon and the Remnant, the area was able to start coming back to life. It's really cool to see. Like, you can even just see it in the color that is added into these scenes. People out, you know, selling robes and cloaks and food. It's really cool. And Cara Dune and Grief clean the place up. So in rolls the New Republic, of course, at the end of the episode to debrief on what happened with the Imperial base that they blew up on Nevarro, the one where they found the laboratory with, you know, whatever those were in tubes being grown for the experiments involving the child. Now, I am mega, mega interested in whatever these things are, but perhaps for another podcast. So the New Republic officer is met by Carl Weathers' Grief, who treats him with disdain, a snide tone in his voice that suggests his surprise that the New Republic even cares what's happening on Nevarro. Clearly, this is the experience of the Outer Rim world. It's part of the culture out here this far in the galaxy. Grief channeled this energy of, we will handle ourselves because A, you don't actually care about people out here, and B, even if you did, you don't know how to help us. The officer then goes to Cara Dune and says something really important. He mentions, like, there's something going on
out here. They don't believe it on the Core Worlds, but it's true. These aren't isolated incidents. They need to be stopped before it's too late. But we can't do it without local support.
And this is his appeal to her. It was almost like deputizing her as a sheriff of an old Western town to try to, like, you know, keep the bandits out and restore order. He wanted her to, like, wear a New Republic badge and sort of bring the New Republic into this region by representing them here in law enforcement. So this is very much related to the Princess Leia belief about the First Order. After the New Republic is founded, she continues to raise the alarm about the threat of Imperial remnants and something seedy going on in the Outer Rim involving sort of Imperial romanticism, and that the Empire is out there recouping, licking its wounds, and planting seeds for a comeback. And most of the Inner Rim elite on Chandrila and then the New Republic think she's a Looney Tune and paranoid. This is all captured in the Hollywood Reporter piece that I mentioned, Nardi sent to me by Richard Newby, who says that, and more or less the piece's conclusion is that the Outer Rim is MAGA country, right? Trump voting states, red states. So there's a lot to chew on there with that comparison. I have said myself on this show that the Outer Rim is the equivalent of Middle America, derisively called flyover country, as if it is a place not worth visiting. And if that is true, what is newbie and what am I suggesting be done? Because in the Star Wars context, it's a New Republic military presence that's very much needed, and a political infrastructure and serious commitment to policing the area and really knitting it together with some semblance of force, but also living in those communities. In the real world context, this area is being left behind by automation, the outsourcing of jobs, the cities are decaying and losing people at a rapid pace, moving elsewhere. The tax base then vanishes in these cities like Detroit and St. Louis. And then the cities decay even faster and faster. It's this death loop of decay where, you know, like the companies leave or they outsource the jobs or they automate certain work. So people leave the area and then the tax base goes away. And then nobody wants to come to the area. So then it just, you know, it just piles up and gets worse and worse and worse. But of course, we're not talking about deploying federal troops to Missouri or Michigan to clamp down on QAnon conspiracy theories and people wearing MAGA hats. That's just outlandish. And that's kind of where the analogy has limits. To solve for that same problem in our own world, we have to reestablish connection and some sense of national unity and common cause. There are not easy answers here. But I do think that the primary driver of the raw anger in the heart of the country is entirely cultural and media related. Like, it is just so apparent, and it's so petty because there are so much bigger things at stake than cultural resentment. But that really matters to people in a way that is just kind of hard to grapple with. Just a really big pissed off energy about the way CNN talks about these people every day. Like, what could fix it? I don't know. High speed rail, national investment to tie the country together even closer so that people are actually passing through this part of the country and not, you know, flying over it. Would it be major companies resettling in the Midwest to bring people back and bring tax dollars and infrastructure and life back to those cities? What if, you know, CNN, what if CNN leaned into the lessons of COVID-19 and realized that many of its people don't need to be in New York City to report the news and do television? Like, we have this thing called Skype. We have these things called ring lights. You can create home studios anywhere in the country, and every television network has been doing it for the past 9 months. So spread the national news media out again. Leave Los Angeles and New York and DC. You don't need to have like associate producers be hired to work at Fox or MSNBC and move to New York to do a job that they could do in St. Louis from a bureau, and starting to get close to the people that they are covering so that when their news reports come out, people in Middle America don't feel like you're talking about them like lab rats or things that you're looking at inside of a terrarium. I don't know, but neither does Star Wars. The problem persists in trilogy after trilogy, and we know where it is headed, and it's really, really bad. The Mandalorian is pointing to it, and the New Republic doesn't solve this. And the First Order festers and rises in the Outer Rim and the Unknown Regions. The New Republic will eventually be destroyed in The Force Awakens, and the galaxy is going to fall into darkness again. So all of this just to say, The Mandalorian got a little political this week, and it's really worth watching. It's in the subtext of the episodes, but it's just really important and really relevant. And this article in the new Hollywood Reporter piece is called "The New Relevance of the Mandalorian" by Richard Newby. I'm going to put it in the show notes. I hope you all will check it out and think about what it is saying. Next up on Beltway Banthas, Brian Silliman of Jabba the Pod and SciFiWire.com joins me to talk, you know, Star Wars. He dishes on his recent interview with Anthony Daniels, a.k.a. C-3PO, and we get into The Mandalorian Season 2, Episode 3, where Bo-Katan makes her on-screen debut. Now, our main focus of this discussion is going to be the fact that The Mandalorian is apparently in some kind of cult called the Children of the Watch and does not know it, thus the never removing of the helmet. And Brian and I are going to talk about, you know, growing up in certain kinds of echo chambers and breaking out of the singular ways in which we might see the world based on where we're from or where we're raised and how we're raised. So there's a lot to get into here. Brian and I go on for some time, and I hope you will enjoy it and find something that you can latch on to here that that means something to you. So let's get to that right now. You had an interview, a five-minute interview with Anthony Daniels, the actor for C-3PO this week. I just wanted to ask you right off the bat, was that kind of like a high point in terms of doing the podcast for you? Is that the first Star Wars actor you've had on the podcast thus far?
Well, I'll say it, as a high point, absolutely. I mean, how could it not be? If it's not, I'm doing the wrong thing if that's not a high point. And he's been very nice to podcasts over the years. I've heard him on other podcasts. He's been around, you know, he's very generous with his time, but we'd never talked to him. I'd never talked to him. And it's part of the big press junket for the Lego holiday special. So that's how they let that happen. So I was not the only one. They put you in one of these Zoom, you know, breakout rooms, and then they call you in one by one. But he was just, you know, being on a Zoom call with him and just listening to him, and he's just so great. And as a kid, you know, I had the C-3PO action figure case. I've always loved C-3PO from the first time as a kid I watched Return of the Jedi. He's a legend to me. And we've been lucky. We've had some great people in just a year of doing the podcast. We've been really lucky with some of the guests. I mean, we've had Ashley Eckstein, and we've had Sam Witwer and James Arnold Taylor, and who am I? Vanessa Marshall, Tia Sirkar. We talked with E.K. Johnston, and early into Mandalorian, we talked with Emily Swallow, and Matt Lanter. I mean, some of these people that have been listening to for a while. So we've been really lucky. But this was in no slight to them, but this was a next level thing, because this was one of my first ever Star Wars memories was C-3PO. And you're just listening to this man's voice my whole life, you know.
Daniels is just so warm and kind, and you just know, and you get the sense that he genuinely loves being part of the Star Wars family, thus him being in nearly every Star Wars property there is up to this point, except The Mandalorian, which you kind really put a fine point on in the interview with him. And I guess we're all just now hoping that in some way he shows up in The Mandalorian. It will probably just be a background role, I would guess, but that's kind of what he does these days.
I'd say you're dead on. I like in Solo, as I pointed out, C-3PO is not in that movie, but Anthony Daniels is. So they could easily, you know, we may not even know that it's it. That's how The Mandalorian does it somehow. It's that you watch this whole episode and then you see in the credits John Leguizamo. And you say, what? Who is he? And then you go back and say, oh my God, he's the one-eyed Abyssin at the very beginning, and you'd never know. They're really great with these, lower status actors, of course, they're wonderful. The amazing character actors, but that not like we'd been spoiled long ago about someone like Timothy Oliphant. So we knew he was coming theoretically, but we didn't know that, you know, for example, Horatio Sanz was going to pop up in the premiere of the entire show. So whenever he pops up, it could be a complete surprise, and we won't know until the credits, which is one of the many, many joys of that show.
No doubt. Well, congratulations on getting to speak with Daniels. That's super cool. Getting a Star Wars actor is a tough thing to do in the podcasting hustle. Yeah. So
they, especially lately, they and with Mandalorian, they don't let them out.
I was convinced for like a couple of days that I was going to actually be able to get Pascal on. Like I was like, oh my gosh, like we'd gotten like a couple of emails into the back and forth, and then it hit a wall. But I was like, oh, it's actually looking like it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah, it usually does, because if you're just it's the actors want to do it and their representation wants to do it. It's Lucasfilm that is really being careful in terms of spoilers and everything else. They have a brand to protect, and this is
that was kind of like my sales pitch to them was, yeah. I don't do spoilers. I don't ask anybody about shows. I'm interested in one thing, which is tell me about politics.
Oh, and then there, I mean, I can see, and then it's like, hello. Hello?
I can't hear you. And I was like, my theory has always been like, oh, you know, they're super protective of facts with Star Wars, and they don't want people pressed on what's going to happen in the shows. But these people are tweeting all day about this and that and saying this and that about politics. What are we going to break that's new here?
But it's true. and they know it, they have all these junkets and stuff, and we ask all these questions. The thing is, it would make more sense to interview after a season, so we can say, it's like, oh my God, that big reveal, what was that like? It's having these big media events. Say, I remember before Avengers Endgame, there were all of these big junkets and interviews, and what are you going to ask? You can't ask them anything because you don't know anything, and they can't say anything. So it ends up being a big, you know, what's your favorite color situation, which is fine, but you know, so of course we, you know, they can't really give anything away, and Dave Filoni is a master at that. I mean, he gets these questions all the time, even more so now, and he can't answer any of them. I'm sure he'd love to, but I mean, also, do we really want them to? Because we don't want to be spoiled.
I've just been to too many cons at this point, and I just don't understand why people walk up to the microphones and try to squeeze things out of these people. But, you know, then again, like, what else are you going to ask? You said, like, what's your favorite color? Which brings me to, Brian, what's your favorite color?
probably green.
Oh, that's a good one.
Or black. I mean, most of my clothing is black.
One of us. Yeah. Well, Brian, I want to pick your brain a little bit about the most recent episode of The Mandalorian. By the time people hear this, we will be on a new episode, one possibly featuring Ahsoka Tano, or at least the search for Ahsoka Tano. But going back to the heiress, this was episode 3, right? Episode 3 was the heiress?
Yeah, it was chapter 11.
Yeah, chapter 11, episode 3, season 2, The Heiress.
Episode 3, season 2, yeah.
This was a really revelatory episode, and for deep-cut Star Wars fans, quite the treat. So if I were just to sum it up in one expression, it would be Bo-Katan. That's it. Bo-Katan is now on screen, unmasked, and live action. And you get new information about our hero, the Mandalorian, Din Djarin, I think is how you would say it. Din Djarin. And we learn something in an interaction with Bo-Katan regarding helmets and keeping your face concealed. Because this has been like one of the big points of contention in fandom since the show got started. We were like, all right, well, we've seen all these shows where Mandalorians take their helmets off. Like, it's not a big deal to anybody on the Clone Wars, but what's the deal with Djarin? Could you just kind of walk people through like what we learned in this episode? I'd love to get it in your words.
Sure. For one thing, it was great. It was great just seeing Bo-Katan, period. And it was rumored that it was going to happen, but rumors are not, you know, the trades will pick them up and they'll report them. But until Lucasfilm puts it on the site or until you see it on screen, I don't believe them. And I really kind of wish the trades didn't break them, because can you imagine if we didn't know that Bo-Katan was coming? If we didn't know that the potential for Katee Sackhoff to show up, if that was just out of the blue on Friday morning and it wasn't rumored, if we didn't know that Timothy Olyphant was Cobb Vanth, or almost certainly going to be Cobb Vanth, and he just popped up, Can you imagine if we hadn't been hearing Ahsoka rumors for months now and they dropped that name? Can you imagine? It's still great to hear it and it's still confirmation, but that's one thing and that's the business. I understand they have to sell the show and that's just the way it is. But this was exciting because whereas I made this mistake on Jabba and in an article, so I'm not going to make it here. We've had this before in terms of an animated character moving into live action. It happened with Saw Gerrera, and it happened with Chopper, both in Rogue One. Chopper is in the background, and you also hear Harrison Dula's voice over the intercom, which is not an appearance, but it's a call out, and it's very cool. But with Saw, the difference is played by Andrew Cascino in the Clone Wars, then played by Forrest Whitaker in live action, and then when Saw went back to animation, played by Forrest Whitaker again, and then also now in all the games and everything, it's always Forrest Whitaker now. So when Saw made that jump, Andrew Cascino did not make the jump with it. What was so cool with Bo-Katan was that it was still Katee Sackhoff. This was an instance where it's the same actor who did the vocal performance and performed them for the animated series, then moved on to live action. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm past the point where I'm like, that's a first, that doesn't happen. Because every time I say something like that, I get in trouble. And it doesn't take much. But it was a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal. And it really plants a flag and says the animated shows matter. I mean, ever since Maul showed up in Solo, pretty much, it was saying.
Yeah, that was the beginning.
and it's satisfying whether you watch those shows, whether you didn't watch those shows. I think if you never watched anything animated, you have no idea who Bo-Katan was. You're watching Mandalorian. I think it's still cool because you're watching another Mandalorian on the show, which is cool. But it's to get back to what you actually asked me, it's a Mandalorian who's taking the helmet off. Yeah. And that's, as you pointed out, if you watch Clone Wars and Rebels, they do that every 6 seconds. it's nothing new. Boba Fett didn't really in the original series. Jango Fett did in the prequels. Jury's still out whether they're, you know, Mandalorians or what.
Even that's an Mandalorians answer at all. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an answer. Or are they foundlings or are they in some kind of other splinter group? I'm really still harping on that whole Minister Almec response in like Clone Wars season 2. I have not forgotten it. And so I'm still hoping with Boba in the mix now, we might get an answer on that. But the big reveal, of course, is that they come out and he's already met Cobb Vanth, who takes his helmet off and he's like, okay, you're not a real Mando. And he's right in that instance, because he's not. He's just a guy wearing the armor. So then we have these three Mandos who take their helmets off, and it's a WWE star, it's Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, and it's Bakshi from Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And he says, okay, well, you just took your helmets off. You're obviously not Mandalorians. And she counters with, I've had this armor in my family for three generations. You're telling me I'm not a Mandalorian? She once ruled all of Mandalore. She's about as Mandalorian as you get. But she drops this thing. And the first line after he says that, and there's this brilliant reaction when they take them off. You can see the visceral physical response he has. Yeah. It's like someone just, you know, sneezed on him and it's flu season or something, you know, and
yeah, that's where that physical acting for Vader like really comes in. Like it's amazing,
very nuanced, and it's very hard to do, and you could tell. And you know, it's like you see something like that, it's like, well, he comes from theater, and he does, and it shows. Anyway, so and the minute he says you took your helmets off, you're not real Mandalorians, the line is, he's one of them. And Bo-Katan just kind of nods. And Din Djarin, who we usually just call Mando, has no idea that, what? Because he, and they say, you're one of, and she lays it out. Bo-Katan lays it out. He says, okay, you've been raised as in a group that she refers to as the Children of the Watch, which she calls a splinter group. She calls it a cult, which is loaded. That's a strong word to throw in there, because that conjures all kinds of things in the real world. doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, just, like with the Mandalorians, the matter of what it means to be a Mandalorian is something that is really, really tied up and kind of messy in the canon. And I don't think anybody had discussed, at least I don't stay on top of kind of like the rumor sites too much, but there hadn't been really any discussion of like the possibility that our hero was in some sort of like weird, bizarre, like religion version of the Mandalorian. And here it is, the children of the watch. And
yeah, we had a lot of theories as to the helmet thing. We were both Filoni and Favreau says, just wait, we have answers for that. We're like, of course you do. And we had a lot of theories and we were wrong on every single one of them. So you realize it's, you know, Mandos, they're not a species. They're a culture. There are so many different, there's not just one creed. There's not just one way. And we realized that the way meant the group that Mando grew up in or was brought up through, whether the armorer is the leader of that covert or not, it's this splinter group called Children of the Watch. And their goal is to go back to a more ancient way. And apparently this was a more ancient way. And I'm not totally up on the legend stories about Mandalorians either. There's just so much of it. Is the thing mm-hmm. before
there's a lot in Star Wars that like really takes on the issue of sort of shattering people's realities. Like I think like at the core of Star Wars, I don't know, like morality compass, like you go back to the very original Star Wars episode 4 and you know Obi-Wan's, you know, from a certain point, actually that's in episode 6 from a certain point of view.
He says did I or is it from a certain point of view? It's in your entire and everything you thought you knew is wrong.
You said your name was Ben.
Well, it's Obi-Wan.
You said my dad was killed.
Close, now ain't this fun? 'Cause technically it's true. From a certain point of view.
Point of view?
Point of view. And I'm not the only Jedi who's screwing with you.
Yes, who?
Yoda, not you.
You see it even up and through something like Rise of Skywalker with Rey. How many times does her world change?
Her identity, you
know,
she
thinks she's, are they nobody? It's like, well, yeah, they're nobody, but you're also a Palpatine. It's like, okay, let's unpack that for a moment. So it's this, not only, hey, everything you knew, not necessarily is a lie, but there's a lot, there's a much bigger world. Like, that's not the only way. And it's loaded because we've all been saying this is the way for a year now. Yep. And now we hear, oh, wait, this could be part of a weird splinter militant group. And that could, and Bo-Katan says it to him twice. She says it in kind of a mocking way. And then at the end, she says it in a real way. She says it in a firm way. So it's thank the Force. She says it like that because it's like there might be more to it.
I picked up on that as well. Like there was this entire like marketing complex now built around this is the way, and to have it turn into some form of snarky derision was actually kind of discouraging for a couple of minutes until they redeemed it. But you know, I got to say, I'm really excited for the Mandalorian. To meet up at some point, we hope, with Ahsoka Tano, a fellow convert, or not a convert, but someone who has kind of escaped the cult life in a way. You're going to have, I think, a little bit of a recovery session between two people who had to grapple with the fact that they were brought into a semi-religious organization from their youngest years against their will, raised in it, and then learned to believe that it's sort of based in a lie, or at least a little bit of corruption and falsehood. I hope that they can go deep with this.
That's a really, really excellent point, because, you know, Ahsoka had her moment of clarity and she still follows the Force and is a believer. And as she says, when people need help, you help no matter what. She just doesn't buy into the dogma of the Jedi and saw through how corrupt that was. And they did her way wrong. And she decided, and she broke away. She had the strength to break away. So if there's anyone who understands what Mando is, what's happening to him, it's her. However, I also hope, and I think it's only a matter of time, that the armorer hits the scene again and he mentions this to her and says, well, this is what I heard. Is this true? And a couple things about this, because the fact that the armorer has little horns on her helmet has always stuck out to me as showing that she could be, you know, on the side that fought for Maul. So who knows where her ultimate loyalties are. I'd pay good money to see a scene with the armor and Bo-Katan just hashing out Mandalorian politics and ways and creeds. I'd watch 3 hours of that. But also, in terms of just Bo-Katan, it's her saying this other thing is a splinter group going back to the old ways. That's loaded, too, because let's not forget the first time we ever met her, she was a member of Death Watch with Pre Vizsla, which was a militant splinter group breaking off from her sister's pacifist ways, and they were not saints. They were burning village, innocent villagers alive, having droids fight each other. They were, Pre Vizsla was not a great guy, and they joined forces with Maul, and then until it was one step too far, and then part of that group stayed with them. So she ultimately broke away and made the right choice, but that's loaded too. So she kind of knows as well, not that she was indoctrinated, but this is, and that also was rooted back in old ways. We're led to believe that this is an even older way, where, because even Death Watch was taking their helmets off. So how far back are you going to go? And it's potentially really far, because they're busting out the name the Mandalore again as the leader of Mandalore, which is an old recanonization.
And even kind of what you laid out, and I didn't even think of it when you mentioned Rey, like all of Star Wars is about self-discovery. Like front to back, it's a hero's journey tale, we know that, but like everything Star Wars does is about shattering people's visions of the way things have to be, what the truth obviously is, and presenting alternatives and allowing people to walk their own path. And I would say that it's like breaking through, you know, sort of like group identity and falling back into like individualism, but it's not that either. It's about chosen family. It's about who do you want to be part of? Who are your people? And are you going to find new ways to associate with them?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, because that's why I know it's a contentious thing with Rise of Skywalker. That is one contentious movie. But I like that what it's saying ultimately, at least for me, is that it doesn't matter how Rey was born. It doesn't matter what blood is it. You could be a Skywalker, you could be a Palpatine. It's your choices that matter. Ben Solo, you know, is a Skywalker. He commits genocide in the course of the sequel trilogy, or is complicit in it. Starts the first movie we see him in, killing Max von Sydow. I mean, no. You don't just get to do that. So it's Rey, on the other hand, is a Palpatine and makes the other choice. It's the choices that define us. And it's why the line from a certain point of view is so pivotal. Even that's why the books, the short story series created around that are also so fantastic, because they make you look at it in a different way. Like, you'll never look at the Wampa again. Everybody in these stories, and everybody in any story, has a story of their own, and it can twist, and you can change. You can go with that change as it happens, or you can stick and say, no, I'm not changing my point of view no matter what. But we have to be wary of absolutes, don't we?
Right. And that's, you know, what I want to ask you, because, you know, this is a Star Wars and politics podcast, and this is kind of where we just kind of get real about that sort of stuff. And I think Star Wars fans, and I'm going to say, like, particularly on the left, have always been a little uncomfortable with Star Wars' commitment to the gray zone when it comes to, like, moral stances, like this sort of, like, moving center that they always commit themselves to, a certain point of view, or cosplaying as Imperials, or bringing in a character like Rey Sloane to make the Empire diverse and not necessarily a white supremacist fascist organization. Like, right. I think it's always been a little frustrating to people that Star Wars blurs things, but they are committed to it, and it doesn't look like they're ever going to stop. And I'm curious what you think of that, and if you think that there is continued value in Star Wars always pushing us to realize that there might be things that are true outside of our own lived experiences.
Yeah, I do. I think there's always I think that's true of any art that has me challenge my ground in thinking and makes me look at things in a whole new way. I don't necessarily agree with them, but wow, I never thought of them in that way. I think that's good. I think that's part of why art matters, and that's why it's important, and that's what good stories do, and that it challenges my ideas, and sometimes my ideas hold firm, and sometimes they waver. you have our convictions, and sometimes it solidifies them even more, and sometimes it doesn't. And with Star Wars is no exception. It's a lot of times, yes, it's space fascism versus, you know, righteous heroes a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But then along comes a movie like Rogue One that says, well, yeah, the rebels had to pull some, you got to do what you got to do to get to where you got to get to. You have a character like Saw Gerrera who does whatever is necessary, what needs to be done. And sometimes I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I think he has a point and he's right. And it's either, you know, he's not going to live to see the glory, but he's going to gladly join the fight. It's not for him. You know, he's sacrificed his body for a greater cause. And then other times it's like, well, let us not forget that what he's doing is genocide bad. So I go back and forth on that all the time. And I like that it constantly makes me ponder that. In the case of Star Wars, you also have bounty hunters and scoundrels and pirates, who a character like Hondo Ohnaka, who is going to be good sometimes, bad another time. You never know which way he's going to go, which side he's going to land on. So there is a lot of gray in between there. But and I think a lot of the a lot of people's frustration, at least with the prequel, when the prequels first came out, and now living in this bizarro world where the prequels are all of the people that grew up with the prequels and love them more than anything else. That's their Star Wars
right now, yeah.
And they're celebrating them nonstop. And I say this all the time, but I'm like, could have used you all 15 years ago, because when I was like mocked for wearing, unironically wearing a Revenge of the Sith t-shirt, people's like, yeah, what are you kidding? It's like, that's funny. And I'm like, no, I actually enjoy the movie.
I had a Revenge of the Sith t-shirt.
Yeah. I still have it. And they're majorly flawed. I'm not going to sit here and say
that. But my question is, was yours the movie poster, or was it the Anakin with the cape, where the face of the Darth Vader's face is in the cape?
Neither. It was just the title. It was in the font, and it came free with the PS2 game and that I went and got right before I went to see it for the first time after I quit a job I hated. It was the best day. But there's this whole prequel renaissance, and but back when they came out, a lot of the frustration was because the excitement was Jedi in their prime, right? It was, we're going to see so many Jedi being the righteous Jedi, and they're all going to be Yodas, and they're all going to be Obi-Wans, and it's going to be great. And then we see it, and they are great, and they do some great stuff, and there's so many lightsabers and everything else, but they're making bad decisions, and they're corrupt as hell. And we see it, and we see the slide, and we see them, as Lucas always said, nothing conquers them. They become it. They slowly become it themselves, and that's how it always kind of happens. That's even in real life. That's how frickin' Rome happened. You know, mm-hmm. It slowly became that, and people let it happen with thunderous applause. And that's why, you know, it was disappointing when people just wanted them to be these heroic ass kickers. But it's more powerful when I identify with them more, because let me tell you, I am just such a failure in so many ways. I am a flawed person. I am so selfish and everything, and so corrupt. And I identify with these fallible Jedi more than I do with these, you know, impressive statuesque heroes. And that's when it hits so much harder later on in the original trilogy, when we meet Obi-Wan again, when we meet Yoda. They have learned their lesson, and now they're making amends. And the same thing repeated itself, I think, with Luke Skywalker in the sequel trilogy. People wanted him, as he says in the movie, what did you think I was gonna do?
Did you hear a word I just said?
You think what? I'm gonna walk out with a laser sword and face down the whole First Order? What did you think was going to happen here?
And the whole audience practically screams yes, because that's what they wanted. Mm-hmm. They wanted Luke Skywalker ripping Star Destroyers out of space, single-handedly joining the fight like John Wick. And so did a part of myself. To be honest, that's not what The Last Jedi is. The Last Jedi is a movie about dealing with failure. And Luke, at that point in his life, thinks he's a failure. And he realizes that, yeah, but that doesn't mean I can't still be worth something. Broken doesn't mean worthless. And it's about sacrifice, and redemption is something I say all the time, for me, is what Star Wars is about. And he breaks out of that. He snaps out of it. He realizes that there's things at play bigger than him.
The rebellion is reborn today. is just beginning. And I will not be the last Jedi.
And that's why that movie has so much power for me. Because if he just stepped up and said, yeah, hero, from moment one, we're good to go, we wouldn't just have that journey. And it's hard to see a childhood hero sit on that island and be a failure and be a grumpy goose the whole time, you know? But it just, I really identify with that, because there are so many times when I want to do the exact same thing. He says, I came to this island to die. And when I'm being really, really dramatic, which is often, I do the exact same thing. I say that line to nobody, because there's nobody here. But, and so this repeats itself. So we have these, you know, heroes can fail. And then you have a character like Kylo Ren turns Ben Solo. It's like villains can be redeemed. Darth Vader, the entire story of Darth Vader, it's the story of Anakin Skywalker. He makes a lot. He kills a whole room full of kids, and then, you know, is a spree across, murder spree across the galaxy for a long time. So you don't get to do that and live, but there, redemption is possible. And the light can return. And it's just that ever moving balance, isn't it? It's in balance, it's out of balance, it shifts this way, it shifts that way, and it goes in cycles. There's always a war in the stars, and every 30 years, fascism will creep back in with a new coat of paint and a snazzy new name. And it's black and white for a little while. We think we know who the players are and what the sides are. And then you take a closer look, and from a certain point of view, it's not as cut and dry, unless you're, you know, a sniveling sleaze bag like some of the Imperial toadies, or who I have no patience for, yeah. Are people like the Trade Federation or the Banking mm-hmm. Clan, those guys who are completely complicit and they have no idea.
Yeah, what, they don't believe in anything. Used. Yeah.
Oh, they're in it for the money, and so is, you know, is it going to make us rich? Great. Sith, what? We don't know what that is. We don't care. We know we're profiting from it, like Geonosians. It's like the Clone Wars would not have happened without them. Their entire culture gets almost wiped out, so there's a single egg and a single member of their species left. Did they deserve that? I don't know. There's a question. There's an ethical conundrum for you. But it's just loaded with questions like that. I didn't mean to go off on that whole long tangent, but that's what ethics and politics and Star Wars does to me, and it's especially in these troubled times.
All right, that was Brian Silliman of SciFiWire.com and Jabba Da Pod. Please subscribe to that and check out Brian on Twitter. You can follow him at Brian Silliman. That is BrianSilliman. Brian Silliman. And follow me at Steven_Kent89 and Beltway Banthas at Beltway Banthas. We're always on there chattering and eager to hear from you on the politics of Star Wars. This entire episode and this bit I was talking about at the beginning was brought about by Dom Nardi, who sent me an article, and I just was like, I really want to talk about this. So you can send me stuff anytime, flag stuff, because I don't catch everything that comes out, op-eds or analyses that have to do with the politics of Star Wars. And if you send it to me, it might just like really hit a note. So, you know, that's why we're here today talking about this. You can subscribe to our newsletter, the Beltway Banthas newsletter, called politicizeme.substack.com. It's called Politicize Me, and you can find it at politicizeme.substack.com. And please do leave a 5-star review for the podcast wherever you're listening, and maybe a few kind words about the show. It does mean a lot, and it helps the show get out to new people. And the last thing is that you can email me anytime at beltwaybanthas.com. I'm sorry, beltwaybanthas@gmail.com. And tell me what you're thinking of the show. Give me some feedback. I want to give a shout out to listener Todd Drenth, who sent me some feedback on our recent roundtable episode of the show. I'm not going to read it word for word, but Todd gave me some thoughts on ways to improve the conversations and make sure that I'm giving listeners a wide range of views at the table while also managing a friendly, constructive chat. And Todd and I went back and forth a little bit about different ways that the show's episodes and roundtables could be more value adding to people listening. So I really value those opportunities to talk to all of you who are out there and just, you know, just say hi. Let me know who you are. I'd love to meet you and chat. So have a happy Thanksgiving. Be safe out there. Take care of others. And remember, we win not by fighting what we hate, but saving what we love. May the Force be with you always.
Last of a Jedi, I said you were, but I wasn't totally straight about your fate. In fact, some say I lied, because Leia is one too. It's true, from a certain point of view.